Session number 10081, Reel 1.
First of all, Mr. Brown, could I ask you about your life in England before the war started? Mm. What sort of area did you come from, and could you tell me something about your family?
The town I was born in, Liverpool. Family, my mother died when I was, I don't know, 5 or 6. So my father married again, and of course he married a Yorkshire girl, and then the whole family eventually moved over to the Wirral Peninsula at a lovely little village called Bevington. It's got its own mayor and that kind of thing. It's grown so big. Well, and then carried on at the Leverhulme, you know, Lord Leverhulme. Well, Port Sunlight was the village nearby. Of course, it's Unilever now, and I went to his school at the age of 15. Then I went straight from at 15 into the Unilever, the Lever, it was Lever Brothers Hospital at Port Sunlight, as a, you know, an office boy. So I stayed there, of course, till the call to arms came in 18.
Did you belong to any sort of organisation such as the Scouts or
yes,
the Boys Brigade?
Yes.
Could you tell me about that, do you
Church
think?
Lads Brigade. Oh, we had a man in charge at Bebbington. He was never got married. His whole life was devoted to boys and the welfare of boys. I've got photographs here. You don't want the photographs now, do you? And the Church Lads Brigade was a hobby. We had our own brass band. We had a camp every year, Skegness 1 year, Ripon the next year, and so on. So up to, they say, the time of joining the army, my whole life was devoted to the village activities under the, you might say, the sponsorship of Major Ormerod.
Well, was there much sort of military involvement with this organisation?
Yes, Church Lights Brigade were partly, we knew the arms drill, never went into, say, tactical exercises, you know, but we had discipline and marching, and we had an inspection every year by a local colonel. We went to a camp, what they call the Northwestern District Camp of London, England, something like 3,000 boys there. So it was. It's still going now very strongly. It's a Church of England branch. Mm-hmm. It's really the Church of England branch of the Boys' Brigade. The Boys' Brigade was started by a man named Smith in Scotland. But they're very, you know, very similar in the cultivation and the helping the boys. So up to the 18.
Well, when you went into the army, yes. I don't want you to give me the details at the moment, but did you find that experience in the Boys' Brigade useful?
Yes.
For your subsequent training?
Yes, yes, yes. Marching and arms drill. They were very useful when the time came, you know. Because we had rifles, you see, but they couldn't fire them, but they were just miniature things.
Did you have any idea of war before it actually broke out? You know, had you heard stories of, say, the Boer War?
Well, no, only at home. My father had a lot of books on the South African War. And naturally, being at home, I used to look at them now and then. So there was always a kind of a military atmosphere. And himself, my father, he was in the old militia in those days.
Yes, what was that, the old militia?
Well, it was in England. It was like it was before the territorials came on the scene. Territorials came later. But I remember seeing the uniform at home, you know. But
did you have any sort of image of war, what it would be like?
No, no. We all thought it was going to be over by Christmas. 18, you're always out for a lark. We might as well join, and it's a bit of a change from everyday life. And we all joined from the head office of Lever Brothers. See, we all joined. The scheme allowed us to all join together. So there were about, you might say, a platoon, which would be about 40 of us joined from the head office of Lever Brothers. We all joined together.
When you say the scheme, was this the Derby scheme?
I don't think it's the Derby scheme. This is the PALS.
The PALS
scheme, which enabled men to all keep together instead of the War Office messing about, putting them anywhere they liked, you see. You could always keep together in the one regiment.
So this is the Liverpool PALS?
Liverpool PALS.
Yes.
But officially, King's Liverpool Regiment. See, that was the War Office designation. And
how did Lord Derby come into this? Because I know you've mentioned Lord Derby.
Yes, well, Lord Derby came in because he started this scheme in Liverpool, and he allowed us to have his... I've got the badge here, I'll show you, of the Derby crest, which is the little baby in the cradle. And we were the four city battalions had a special dispensation from the War Office to wear in the caps the Derby crest. I'll show you. I've got an actual one here.
Yes, I'd like to see that.
And
yes.
That was the beginning of it, really, you know, and he took a great interest in us, you see.
So you were just 18 at the time, were you?
Well, I was 18 in the February of August, so I'd be perhaps 18 and a half.
And this would have been right away, would it? Soon after the outbreak of war?
Yes. I joined in August 1914. We all attested at the... You've heard of the St George's Hall at Liverpool. Everybody attested there. And you know, I've seen men... The medical officer wouldn't pass them for the army, and I've seen fellows burst into tears because they couldn't join the army. But you don't get that today, do you? No, they're so keen to join. It was a wonderful spirit. So that's up to the beginning of the war. Now then, I don't know what you want to know. Now, what's next?
Having joined the army, volunteered as you did,
yes.
What did your parents think of that? Well, you were a young lad, weren't you?
Well, my father... I better give a bit of history of my father. He was in the GPO, Liverpool. He started as a telegraph boy, and he ended his life, I'll show you later, as postmaster at Palace in Jerusalem. In those days, there was no, like the Second World War, where they had a proper postal service. In the First World War, it was run by the Royal Engineers. Royal Engineers did the postal service, and of course they asked for volunteers. Well, he's a bit of a wanderer like me. He volunteered, you see, so he was away quite a long time during the war, and that's how he came to be in the Royal Engineers, you see.
That's interesting that they were responsible for the delivery of mail to the front, weren't they?
Yes, they were, and he had to come down to London to the big Mount Pleasant headquarters, London, to training to get the workings between the army and the civilian post. So he'd served his whole life. He'd had a very adventurous life before then with the post office. He was on the travelling post office, which is the trains move and it gathers the mail on the way. And after that, he went on the Queen Elizabeth taking the mails to America.
But if I could keep to the war...
Yes, the war. We're getting off.
Yes.
I'm just seeing how my father comes into it.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
But this is interesting, you know, about the deliveries during the war, because you were obviously at the front, at the other end of it.
Yes.
Was it good, the postal service? You know, did you get letters and parcels through quickly?
Oh, yes. Of course, I don't know about... I was talking about France, see, I was only concerned. But the post came all right. Oh, yes, no trouble. Unless there was a bombardment going on and then the poor old post chap couldn't get through, you see. It might be a day today. No, no trouble with mail. But then, of course, I don't know whether you know, but you're only allowed... In the First World War, they had what they called green envelopes and green postcards. And the postcards, I haven't got one now, but it says in about printed, I am quite well, I am not so well. And it was to avoid, and you sent that, they gave you three of those every so often, and a green envelope, which had to be read by an officer before being posted, you see, letting information go. But you could always write a private letter, I suppose. But I didn't write many letters because there's only my family to think about.
And would there have been a special job as postman at the front? Was there a particular...
Every battalion had a post corporal. And his job was to go to the distributing centre, I don't know, the army centre, and collect the post every day. Divide it into units and see that it's forwarded by runner to the front line, if you're in the front line. So there was a post corporal in every unit, you might say. But of course, we're not concerned with the post, are we?
Yeah. But this is interesting information. It's a little deviation, but it is related to your father. Yes. But now I'll get back to my original question. You know, how did he react, and your mother, to the fact that you had joined up?
Oh, they didn't mind at all. They just took it. There was nothing emotion about it. It was just that you went and off you went.
Where did you go? You know, what were your initial movements?
We attested St George's Hall, Liverpool.
What is being attested? What does that involve?
Means you take the oath to the Queen. And you officially accept the king's shilling, and you sign on the dotted line and all that, you know. I had a shilling a day, only one shilling a day, you know. And I sent half to my mother, so I was getting sixpence a day. But you see, sixpence went a very long one long way in those days. And when you're 18, you don't smoke very much, you don't drink really, that kind of thing. So it's, and then the army always gave you a ration. There was a ration of cigarettes once you got an active service. They were filthy cigarettes, but still, they didn't worry me very much. But anyhow, we came back to, we had tested in Liverpool. We were all sent home to await instructions. We're still in civilian clothes, mind you. Then, to tell you the truth, the authorities didn't know what to do with the men. There were no barracks. The 1st Battalion was sent to the watchworks at Preston. We were the 2nd Battalion, and they sent us to the Hooton Racecourse in Whittle. And we had to clean out the stables and sleep on palliasses. And we're still in civilian clothes. See, that was our first move to Hooton. It's still there now, Hooton Racecourse, in Whittle. Then people were wondering, when are we going to get some uniform? And this is a funny part about it. It came in dribs and drabs. You've got weekend leave, you see, because we're all near home. Chaps would go on leave with just a pair of khaki trousers and an ordinary coat. Next day, the tunic might come. Or perhaps some chaps didn't even get a tunic, but perhaps they had something else, perhaps a hat. And they went home just like that. See, the army boots, well, the fellows in the last war, it was picnic, but the army boots in those were just like raw leather. So, you see, the country wasn't prepared for it, you see. So, just to sum up, you got your uniform in pieces. Trousers 1 week, a tunic the next week, a cap the next week, And it was laughable in a way, you know, really, when you come to think of it. But we were in such good spirits. We all took it in a wonderful esprit de corps, marvellous. And because the officers we all knew, because they were usually with us from the officers and that, the big shipping companies of Liverpool, the Cotton Exchange, they were all they were the cream of Liverpool, the commercial side of Liverpool, White Star Line, Cunard Line. We had wonderful men, wonderful. Now then,
do you think that made the sort of pals,
yes,
regiments different?
Absolutely,
from others?
Just like cement. It was marvellous.
And you wouldn't have got a division between the officers and the other ranks, is that right?
Yes, marvellous, marvellous. And then, of course, we knew them. We used to call them by Dick, Tom and Harry, you see. A lot of them had got the commissions because a lot of them had come straight from the OTC, University Officers Training Corps, you see. So they knew quite a bit about military training and that. Anyhow, we got as far as Houghton. I think we stayed there a winter. And then in the meantime, authority started to wake up. Lord Derby had a big encampment built at Knowsley Park. That's his home. And the next move was to Knowsley Park, Liverpool, where we had proper huts, heating and all that. That was the next move. All the time we were building up our military training, really getting fit, plenty of physical drill and that kind of thing. Then the colonel was appointed. Oh, he was a grand chap. His name was Trotter. Colonel Trotter, I think his brother, was aide-de-camp to the then Prince of Wales. He's ex-guards. Never married. He'd been in the South African War. I think he was wounded in the throat. But the men would have followed him anywhere. And he came down to London and went to the guards' headquarters and selected four company sergeant majors and a regimental sergeant major from the guards. So we really had guards training, and they did put us through it too. The regimental sergeant major Walters, 6'7". I don't know what size boots he took, really. And do you know, his guards training was so good that when the band was playing in front, he would go to the drum major and say, "I'll take over, you're going too fast." And because the guards use the pace stick, you know. The guards never hurry in their march. There's always a steady march. So it shows the guards' training. He was able to take the bandmaster, show him the right paces. So we had a very good training there. The company sergeant majors were terrors. They used to make us go around. They had a mulberry bush in Houghton, and they used to make us before breakfast go round this mulberry bush. And they used to have his stick, you know, the sergeant major's stick. If you didn't put your legs up high, he'd tap you on the ankle on the way down. Oh, he was a terror. I didn't look at him. He was so fierce looking. So chap he was. His name was West. Came from Leicester.
What was his name again?
West.
West.
Company Sergeant Major West. The regimental sergeant major was Walters. He was a fine old chap, but West was a terror. But they did. They gave us. We were working up. Now, working up to when they wanted us to go over abroad, you see. Then we got as far as Knowsley Park. That was the big camp that Lord Derby put up for us.
Had you had any rifle training at this stage?
Yes, rifle training, but we hadn't got the proper rifles. We had to... all we were doing was learning how to sight and how to fire, you see. But there wasn't a rifle to every man at that time. It's a wonder we won that war, isn't it?
Anyhow, how about bayonet drill? Did you have bayonet drill as well?
Oh, yes, yes, bayonet drill, yes, yes, that was pretty fearsome. Sacks, you know, on poles, and you had to charge it and come back. But it you had to do now, you know. Yes, oh, we had all good trainers. They, of course, being ex-guards, they knew what was right to say. And the colonel, the British Army, the colonel said the British Army was noted for its rifle shooting. And in the retreat from Mons, when the Germans were going, started off to go through Belgium, they said that it was the British rifle fire that kept the Germans back. So they concentrated on rifle fire. Quick, rapid fire, as they called it, rapid fire. That was the training. And bayonet drill.
How about bombing? Did you have any Mills bombing training?
Yes, Mills bombs, yes, yes, in the early stages, yes.
I suppose this would have been a bit early for gas training, would it? Was there any...
We had no... At that time, what was that now, 15, we had no gas training. In fact, there were no respirators. But to progress, we got as far as Nosa Park. That was 1915. Yes. Then it was time for us. We'd done what they call battalion drill. But it was now time to do brigade. That was the next move. So they moved us to Belton Park near Grantham. Lord somebody's place there. It's still there now. To get brigade training. And then we had all kinds of night marching and that kind of thing. That's right, night marching. And then we stayed there for brigade training. The next move, Salisbury Plain. The next move was Salisbury Plain to have divisional training before getting ready for France, you see. Salisbury Plain near Ainsbury, and we had to do tactical exercises at night. And one particular night, I forget, somebody had a bright idea that if the men were moving in lines and the flank men had a telephone line in their hands, a man with a telephone here, this end, and a telephone the other end, they could talk to each other as the unit advanced. Well, that was all right. So the first chap came to a hedge, you see, and he's got his legs cut entangled, and of course the whole thing fell to bits because everybody was getting entangled with wire. And the next day the Corps headquarters sent a message down, "Will please the signal companies go out and collect all the wire lying over Salisbury Plain? There's miles and miles of wire."
Were you involved at that stage with signals, or did
Yes.
You were.
I've always. Yes. Well,
when did your training start? You know, with signals.
Oh, in England, yes, yes.
At Salisbury, was it, or before then?
Oh, before Salisbury, yes. We started signals in Knowsley, you see, signals then.
Mm. Could you tell me about the training for signals?
Well,
why you were selected rather than other?
Well, you had a choice. If you volunteered for the signals, and signals have always attracted me, a lot of fellows wouldn't like it at all. They wanted to stay in the ranks. But we had all the... we had the semaphore flags, we had the telephones, and, of course, Morse was the main thing. But I took to it right away. I used to love signal work. Marvellous. And
you were trained in those aspects of it,
yes,
were you? The telephone,
yes,
Morse and semaphore.
Yes, yes. We got as far as Salisbury Plain.
Yes.
We got that. That was the final training ground where you had, of course, there's so expansive ground there that they could do divisional exercises. You know, going on night manoeuvres and all that kind of thing.
Yes. So I suppose your signals training kept pace,
yes,
did it?
Kept pace, yes.
The sort of battalion,
yes,
level and then divisional.
And men were coming back from the front line to tell us really what conditions we would find out there and what we had must learn to expect. See, there were men coming back all the time during that time, telling the men in England, you know, what it was like. Just an idea. Anyhow, we stayed at Salisbury Plain until October 15. And then there was the whole division on the move to France, 15.
But before we go into your move to France, I wonder if I could ask you a little bit more about the equipment you were using for signalling. You know, you've mentioned that you had the semaphore, the flags, but for your Morse, I'm wondering about your transmitters and receivers. What sort of complexity?
Well, you always had what they call dummy tappers to work on, so you could practice your Morse like that way, you see. Then we practice taking messages and that kind of thing. It was more or less getting to the way of using Morse very quickly. You see.
You didn't have proper sets at that time, did you? Transmitters and receivers?
No.
We got
that later. Well, we didn't have any in France at all.
Yes.
Or in England, rather.
No. I'd be very grateful, Mr. Brown, if you could keep us abreast of the development of the signals equipment as the war goes through, because this is something, you know, we are trying to find out the details of. But now I think you say you're going over to France. But before you go, I wonder if I could ask you, you know, these different areas you went to, Houghton, Knowsley Park, and then Belton Park, and finally Salisbury.
Yes.
Did you have much contact with the civilians in the area?
No. It was camp life all the time. You'd go out in the evening, of course, but...
How were you treated by the population generally?
Oh, very good. Yes, very good indeed.
Yes. Would you say you were made a bit of a fuss of?
Yes. Well, because we were like them. We were really there. I expect their own brothers and sisters, or brothers were in the army. The people were wonderful. Especially when they knew that we were not the regular army, but, you know, part of the PALS battalion. We knew how to get on them, really. You didn't see very much of the civilian. But you were in fact, you were so tired after the drilling and all that you were glad to get to bed early sometimes. You had nights out, of course. You go down in the Tercine to Grantham or something like that, so drink or two of beer, and by the time you got back, you were ready for sleep, you see, so, and up early in the morning.
I was wondering about the people of Liverpool as well, as you were the PALS battalion.
Thought the world of. Yes, they were marvellous. They raised a comforts fund for us when we got to France. The whole town was really with us, you know. It was really marvellous. We had no trouble there.
Did you have leave before you went overseas? You know, I'm wondering.
Yes, well, everybody got 48 hours leave, and you knew then that you were ready for France. The 48 hours leave, everybody received that just before I went to France.
What were your feelings about going over to France? You know, this would have been 1915, wouldn't it?
Something new, excitement, going to a foreign country. In other words, going to war, you know. We were such a marvellous battalion with a wonderful colonel and officers that it was like going from home to home, you see. There's no bickering, anything like that. It was marvellous. Discipline was good. You got the odd one, of course, who did something silly, but then... And it's rather funny talking about that. It's the first time I ever came across where a man was discharged from the army. I don't know what the ceremony is in the army, but he has all his buttons cut off. I don't know what this man had done, whether he'd raped a girl, because it was terrible in those days, but he did something funny, and the whole battalion assembled in a square, and the colonel came along, the master tailor would give him a pair of scissors, and he cut all the buttons. There's a name for it in the army, dismissed with ignominy or something like that. But this chap, poor chap, had to stand there with all his buttons was cut off. I've never seen that before as punishment. But he didn't. He was jolly glad afterwards. He said, I got out of that one all right. And, oh, of course there was punishment.
He remained in the army.
He's finished.
He was dismissed.
Discharged, yes. I don't know whether they got him back afterwards or not. Otherwise, I think probably, I don't know whether it was an army offence or whether it was civilian, but I think it had been civilian, he'd have been in the law court, in the courts, you see. But we had field punishment in France, you know. Oh, yes, you were tied for the gun wheel. I've seen that once or twice.
Have you really?
Oh, yes. Yes, you're tied.
Field punishment number one.
That's it, field punishment number one, yes. And then you had that, they tied you all day in the morning, in the afternoon the regimental sergeant major would give you pack drill for 2 hours, you see. But they're in the very circumstances that were really bad, you see. I don't know whether they got mixed up with some of the French civilians or something like that. Oh, no, but generally speaking, we had no trouble. Anyhow, we got to France.